James himself always felt that the most effective role for him was a role as a mediator. He believed that he could contribute most effectively to peace by not really siding exclusively with either side, either with Spain on the one hand, let's say, or with the Protestants in Germany on the other side. You'll recall that the Elector Palatine, who had accepted the Bohemian crown and caused all kinds of problems for the Austrian Habsburg, was James's son-in-law. And what's interesting is that James had hoped to balance the marriage of his daughter to the Elector Palatine, this leading Protestant prince, with the marriage of his son to the crown of Spain. Up until very recently, a deep enemy of the English crown, and it's a nice illustration of the kind of neutrality that James tried to maintain. James was always trying to keep the channels open during the early 17th century. He urged Frederick to renounce the Bohemian crown and negotiate with the Holy Roman Emperor. At the same time, he sent envoys to Spain to urge them not to intervene directly in the Rhineland. In both cases, James's warnings were not heeded. Frederick refused to renounce the Bohemian crown, and in the spring of 1621, a Spanish army from Flanders invaded the Rhineland Palatinate. This now forced James, for all his diplomacy, to try to consider sending military assistance to his daughter and son-in-law, and of course this would require money, and therefore parliaments had to be summoned in both 1621 and again in 1624. Now, it should not be pretended that these parliaments were completely peaceful. There was great opposition to the idea of the king's son marrying a daughter of the crown of Spain. There were even intimations that James was insufficiently committed to the Protestant cause for him even to suggest this. Parliament now even began trying to debate foreign policy, which it should be stressed was unprecedented. Elizabeth I had never allowed her parliaments to discuss foreign policy. But, like I said, in the 1620s, Parliament didn't listen to this. It called for a crusade against Spain and the predictable international Catholic conspiracy. It called also for stricter measures against the recusants, that is to say, English Catholics at home. Not only did Parliament do that, but it also undertook investigations into royal grants of monopoly and went so far as to impeach two crown ministers, that is to say, to put them on trial for corruption. James, of course, didn't like this. He reacted sharply to these criticisms, and he said some things which certainly alarmed Parliament. But on the credit side, for all this tension between James and Parliament, there really is no evidence of a serious breach between the monarchy and the Parliament itself. After all, many of the attacks on James's ministers were not so much a reflection of an attempt by Parliament to gain power as rather the product of factional rivalries among James's own counselors, who actually encouraged Parliament, in some cases, to go after their own enemies at court. To look to the bottom line, it's worth stressing that both parliaments did, in the end, cough up the money. James received £140,000 from the Parliament of 1621 and fully £300,000 from the Parliament of 1624. James, in all of this, kept firm control of foreign affairs and judicious compromises, for example, abandoning the idea of his son Charles marrying a Spanish princess, he married a French princess instead, diffused an awful lot of the tension. So we can see James facing these structural crises, but through flexibility, managing to prevent them from ballooning into problems that he couldn't control. James, however, died in 1625 and was succeeded on the throne by his son Charles I. And Charles's ascension in 1625, it has to be said, marks a kind of turning point in the relationship between the monarchy and its subjects. And a lot of this is because of Charles's personality itself. I've stressed the importance of a king's personality in 17th century England, indeed in 17th century Europe as a whole. It's worth stressing that Charles I really didn't have any of his father's political flexibility. He didn't seem to know what the word compromise meant. He also was somewhat shy and didn't speak as often to what you might want to call the political nation as he might, as perhaps he should have. And this made it possible for people to interpret his words as they saw fit or even to misinterpret his own words. Moreover, Charles's court, and here again we see a difference with his father James, Charles's court soon came to work for the benefit of a really only narrow range of factional interests, represented above all by Charles's favorite, the Duke of Buckingham. This was a real mistake. An early modern monarch had to distribute the spoils, as it were, of the system widely. And when Charles allowed Buckingham a kind of monopoly, a virtual monopoly on royal patronage in the early 1620s, this not only antagonized an awful lot, many members of the political nation, but it drove them to look somewhere else for their careers. It drove them to begin looking to Parliament to realize their ambitions rather than the king's court itself. Charles's other mistakes, and he made a great many of them, also extended into the area of foreign policy. Charles promptly abandoned the relatively pacific foreign policy of his father James and plunged England into a whole series of war, first of all against Spain, the wicked conquerors of the Palatinate, and then also, if that weren't enough, against France, who were oppressing their Huguenot population. Now,